support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Hugh Muir.
The NHS is on the ballot paper in May because it is already at breaking point and all he offers is five more years of crisis.
Everybody loves it. Everybody's worried. Is the election turning into a referendum on the NHS? From Brussels with love, José Manuel Barroso makes the case for Britain in the EU. Not everyone thanked him for it, but was he right? And the headline The Sun could have written, but didn't. Nigel's kippers come a calypso cropper.
The British people have been let down. That's why UKIP is making ground.
Joining me for all of this, The Guardian's political columnists Raphael Baer, Anne Perkins and Michael White. Welcome aboard, all of you. Let's start with the NHS in England. It's asking for an extra £8 billion before 2020 to avoid a financial meltdown. The head of the service, Simon Stevens, has set out a five-year plan that would involve more reorganisation of services and cost more money. So how's that going to play in next May's election, Anne Perkins?
I think this is a really big and very interesting challenge for the politicians because what Simon Stevens has done is a massive coalition. All the NHS England leaders are behind this. It's a clear outline of what has to be done. And it says we can do all this. We can deliver fantastic efficiency gains, rather optimistically in my view. But we can't do it without a lot more money and much, much more money than any of the politicians so far has said they'll pay. Now, I like to believe this will mean we have a really serious grown-up debate about how much we love the NHS and what we're really prepared to pay for it. And we may reach some reasoned conclusion. I'm not completely persuaded yet that it's going to happen.
Mike, since the financial crisis, we've got used to mind-boggling figures and kind of rows of zeros. So in that context, is 8 billion that much?
No, half of it is sort of inflation, and I'm not sure quite what it means. He says, in effect, we need 8 billions of extra funding plus 20 billion, I think I've got the figure roughly right, of more efficiency, in other words, better working practices and better behaviour by us, the voters. Guardian's editorial left that point out today. It's about us getting to behave better.
I don't think it did.
Yes, it did. And, you know, we've been here before. Most of what Stevens said in his very sophisticated report, a clever fellow, comprehensive schoolboy, raised in the NHS, etc., was said by Geoffrey Wanless, Gordon Brown's obliging banker, in 2004, before they shuffled all that extra money in. But it isn't all about money. It's about organisation and it's about personal behaviour. It's about lifestyles. They're the real killers. Fags, booze, drugs, muffin tops, chocolate at the checkout queue in the supermarkets, all the usual stuff. And do we take much notice? Frankly, no.
Raph, I do want to get your take on this, but first of all, Anne Perkins, you wrote that leader today. Do you want to defend yourself?
Well, I'm quite sure. I'm resisting the temptation to read it out loud tonight,
but
I'm confident that I did mention prevention. But I think it's a really interesting and serious project. But I think that even though it looks so authoritative, that so much of what he wants to happen, as Mike hinted, is outside his control. He can't make us personally responsible for our health. He can only say that.
He's also optimistic about economic growth, too. He says the 3.2% we're getting this year is going to go on and on. Well, he's not concentrating. It's going to be awful.
Raphael, Labour are saying it's the NHS stupid, basically, aren't they? I mean, this is their best card.
Well, it's become, frankly, their only card, which is exactly why they're being forced to play it.
Do you think that? Because I heard Jeremy Hunt saying that today, that you know, basically Labour are concentrating on the NHS because they haven't got anything left.
That's not a bad summary of the situation to the extent. I mean, the Labour report would be actually, look, we've got a whole raft of policies, we've got all sorts of things, we've got lines on the economy and wages and housing and the rest of it. But the simple fact is, if you look at the polling, what is the one issue where people really line up behind Labour that will say quite clearly that they think Labour are the strongest party on this issue and they care about? It's the NHS. So just in sort of political technology terms, what Labour have to do is increase the salience of the NHS in the election. I need to make it absolutely clear that this is, you know, the, if you love the NHS, the one thing you absolutely have to do, as they would see it next May, is vote to get rid of the Tories, vote for Labour.
24 has to save the NHS, to
and
call
they are,
the
they
phrase,
are encouraged
Tony.
In that endeavour by what happened over the summer in Scotland, interestingly, where there are all sorts of reasons why there was a little surge for support for the Nationalists. But one of them, it seems quite clear, was when Alex Salmond basically changed his campaign strategy very abruptly and said, actually, one of the reasons you want independence in Scotland is to save the NHS from the Tories. Labour saw that and thought, ah, that actually works. And this is, as I say, without clear lines on immigration, benefits, economic growth, other things, the NHS is a very important card for Labour.
I think so. It is an important card, though, but not the only card, Mike.
Well, it's the other way around. Alex Salmond took that cynical NHS line in Scotland from the Labour playbook. Labour always plays this card. The Tories are now playing it against Labour in Wales. It's awful. The Daily Mail bored its readers on the front page for 3 days in a row this week, almost a record, about Wales. Because Labour runs the NHS in Wales, doesn't run it particularly well. It's a poor country with bad health outcomes. They are all being short-sighted, cynical and stupid because, as Stevens is trying to say today, let's not make the NHS a political football, but they all pump it up.
And I made a very good point about the, exactly this, that as well as the fact that there's just that you need a lot of money, one of the things that I take from Stevens stuff is the structural reforms he calls for. And actually, when you speak to people who don't want this to be partisan political, and whether because they've studied different health systems or they are in the sort of multi-centre of British politics and try not to be too tribal about it, they all say very similar things, which is that you need to move away from the model where everything is done in big centralised Victorian-era district general hospitals. You need more prevention. You need more things being done by clinics, sort of boosted GP surgeries rooted in people's communities. And there's actually quite a lot of consensus around that. And you've got two basic problems. One is consensus on this issue, as Mike has just said, is impossible, especially in the run-up to an election.
Political consensus. Yeah.
But also, crucially, the current government has squandered the opportunity for a big radical reform by doing one which was beside the point, really unpopular and pretty unsuccessful. Yeah. So you've sort of, they had the bullet and they fired it in the air, and now it's so much harder to get agreement on it, so much harder to depoliticise it, and so much harder to persuade people that you need reform.
If everyone agrees that we have to have a fusion within the health service of traditional provision and new providers, private providers, why are some people so wary of Simon Stevens, who seems to be advocating just that?
I suppose the point is he comes from a private health background, although he did do 15 years in the NHS before he went to America. And he's also behind some of the original Blairite purchaser-provider split reforms in the NHS. So his critics feel that he's got form on at least the breaking up of the NHS, and potentially, you know, he sees privatisation as the right route. I have to say, I don't think I've read from an NHS manager a more wholehearted endorsement of the NHS, not just as an institution, but as a part of British society, as an important part of the way we think of ourselves. So I am hugely reassured by his objectives, which I think genuinely and completely and clear-sightedly is to find a way to make this extraordinary institution viable and sustainable in the medium term.
Yeah.
Mike, being a devious sort, you kind of recognise deviousness from a way off. Do you see deviousness in all this stuff the Daily Mail have been writing about Wales? Is this concern?
Well, not
is this
devious, government- it's very straightforward. The Tories need to neutralise the NHS, as Raph said, as a Labour issue. Labour overcooks it. Labour's role has been very destructive too. That's the point I wanted to make. Labour came into office in 1997 promising to undo Ken Clark's purchaser-provider split. They did it for a year. Then Frank Dobson, different chap, went off to be Mayor of London. Whoops. No, he didn't. And Alan Milburn came in as one of the 10 great, all the experts say, reforming post-war health secretaries. Did it all. Andy Burnham, a lot of privatisation stuff. Hunt gets up and says, we're using your legislation to do what you're complaining about, Mr. Burnham. And Burnham has gone back again. So we're back in the Frank Dobson role in the cycle. It's destructive. And a lot of people out there, sincere, decent people, say, NHS privatisation, da-da-da. And Stephen says, you know, it's got about 5% of the market. The NHS is a monopsony, not a word Raphael will pronounce it properly. It's a monopoly purchaser, and there's not enough diversity and innovation in the system. There's a lot. It's bloody wonderful. I was in a hospital myself only this week. My daughter-in-law is about to have an NHS baby. We all use the NHS, but it ain't perfect, and we need to break it up.
Well, I said it was devious was that obviously ministers aren't making these speeches, though, aren't they? In a way, they're subcontracting the work out to the Daily Mail.
Well, it's the Wales thing. Well, the ministers are actually. Prime Minister's Question Time yesterday, and probably more than half the Prime Minister's Question Times this year, somebody has lobbed Cameron the Welsh NHS ball, and Hunt does it a bit too. Hunt's got to be more consensual because, you know, he's got to keep the show afloat. Fact is, under devolution policies, which the coalition favours because of what happened in Scotland, Hunt and Burnham and Cameron are not responsible for the NHS in Wales. Carwyn Jones, the First Minister, is, and Salmon and Nicola Sturgeon, who used to be the Health Minister in Scotland, too. They've all got their problems, although, in fact, expert opinion says, or expert analysis, they're all converging. They're all, although going on different roads, their outcomes and performances are moving, they're getting better, and they're getting better in the same sort of ways, despite the politicians.
Raph, what is it with the NHS and politics? Why is it so visceral? Why does everyone grab this ball and run with it?
Well, I mean, partly because it is woven into the fabric of our lives and our experiences.
Nearest thing the English have to a religion.
Yeah, oh my God, he's quoting Lord Lawson now.
And you know, there are the specific circumstances of this government, and we've talked about sort of how Labour feels and needs, particularly at the moment, to politicise it. It is interesting though that other countries, certainly other you know, continental European countries, are less sort of theologically schismatic on this question of who actually provides their care. So, you know, obviously, the model no one wants to pursue would be the sort of the US one. That's pretty taboo for very good reasons, I think. But it's interesting that certainly in France, it's not impossible to have a system where people get universal healthcare, but they also have an insurance model, and sometimes you pay and then you claim back. And
it's a top-up.
There are ways of having either fees that are recompensed or an insurance system that is essentially underwritten by the government. And it is not, it doesn't have to be this point of sort of religious zeal that it all has to be provided monolithically by the state, free at the point of use, and still be a universal public healthcare system. But in this country, we are theological about it.
French towns have you know, private in a public hospital. Which do you want to go to, the clinic or the university hospital?
Neither.
It's been one of the dividing lines of post-war British politics. It's the last substantial vestige of the post-war settlement, and it is the state. Of course, it's a, you know, you couldn't make it. If you designed a system to be a political football, the NHS is what you divide.
Stephen says the Thatcher attempt to privatise funding has gone away, that all the parties agree that the NHS should be free at the point of use and funded by the taxpayer. That's part of the new consensus too.
And someone told me that what Stevens is up to is that in between the party conferences and the election, this is basically him getting his pitch in, so all of the politicians can then argue about who's going to help him the most. He's a manager. How much of a politician can he be in this process?
I mean, I think this was an immensely political decision. it was so brilliantly political,
yeah,
wasn't it, Mike?
Yeah,
you know, if you're a real conspiracist, you could say this has been kind of 5 years in the planning. But it's certainly, you know, we've for the last year or more, there's been this sort of steadily mounting drumbeat about the huge gap in NHS finances from very reputable sources, the King's Fund, the Health Foundation, Nuffield Trust. They've all said there is this real crisis approaching. And they've also all said the politicians didn't address it in 2010. We've got to make sure they address it this time. The King's Fund, on its excellent website, is actually running a monitor, you know, a sort of daily monitor of the politicians' pledges on the health service. So Simon Stevens has paid straight into that, and now he's set out this manifesto and challenged the politicians to.
Okay, well, speaking of excellent websites, we have an excellent website, and if you want to find out more about what Simon Stevens is actually up to, you can turn to it. That's theguardian.com. And if you're interested in more about what Simon Stevens is up to, you could look out for a full interview with him in this Saturday's Guardian, conducted by one of our less reputable writers, me. Let's turn to the other issue that looks set to dominate the months ahead, and that is Europe. For this week, the outgoing president, José Manuel Barroso, was in town as part of his European lap of honour as he steps aside next month. And he had some things to get off his chest. He said any arbitrary cap on free movement of labour would be illegal. And as for David Cameron, well, he's making a historic mistake in his aggressive posturing towards the EU. Raph, I always liked that phrase, nothing in his life became him like the leaving of it. Is that what we would say of Barroso?
I think this is...
Not that he's dying, but
no,
you get what I mean.
But I don't mean... And I think this is, he's getting something off his chest here for sure, and he is expressing in public some frustration that has been for a long time, I believe, expressed in private, and he's expressing it in terms that are actually much more diplomatic than some of the terms that it has been, that have been expressed. I mean, essentially the view in the commission, and I've heard this from commissioners and their officials over the last couple of years, is what they will say is, we understand that David Cameron is under this tremendous political pressure from his own party, from UKIP. We're sympathetic with his view that the EU is unresponsive and that the British public has issues with that, and he needs to deal with it. But if he is sincere in his view that ultimately the end game for the Conservative Party and for David Cameron in particular is to stay in the European Union in some form, he has to actually make that case now. He's done as much appeasement and pandering as he possibly can, and it's time to start talking in realistic terms about what can actually be achieved. And what Barroso said specifically on free movement was very important, because that is actually a kind of a Rubicon. If David Cameron is suggesting to his party and to the electorate that actually there's a way of very substantially derogating from the obligations of free movements while also being a member of the European Union in any way, anything that looks like existing terms or the current union, he is lying to people. It's not possible. Those two things actually contradict one another. And so Barroso is just saying, you know what, Cameron, if you want to actually be in this thing, you've got to behave like someone who looks like they want to be in it, because otherwise we'll just think you're lying, and that's no way to negotiate.
Are they helping him as much as they could, though? I mean, Anne, this is about Rochester, isn't it? And surely there are people in this country, the EU representatives here, could well tell Barroso that Cameron has to say what he has to say just to get through the Rochester debacle to come.
But Barroso was surely sort of describing the view from Brussels, wasn't he? And
but in their way, they want to help Cameron, don't they? I mean, they
repeatedly help him, don't they? I mean, they, you know, like our new representative on the EU Commission, a man of whom nobody in Britain had ever heard, let alone in Europe, has been given a good and serious job.
I don't like the appeasement strategy. The more you talk about Europe, the more the Euroskeptics get traction. There were polling, incidentally, this week which says that support for staying in is higher than it's been at any time since 1991.
I saw that, the Morrie poll.
So, you know, the UKIP really rides on immigration, but because it's not a respectable issue, then it's dressed up as the EUC. It's you know, it's like talking about house prices rather than who your neighbours are. So, Cameron has very unattractive in what he's done. He keeps being painted into a corner and then into a smaller one. That said, you listen to people like Barroso and the commission briefers and even the Germans, and you say, hang on a minute, our problem with immigration is that we are seated with a growth-focused economy, 3.22%, fairly open borders and labour markets, where people are piling in. Why are they piling in? Because the Eurozone is tanking really badly. Even the German economy, export-orientated, having bankrupt everybody else, is now in the process, wholly predictable, of bankrupting itself because it can't export its own way into renewed growth.
Now, I think actually UKIP have done something very clever. They've done the exact opposite in a way. They realised that they weren't getting traction on Europe. And the idea of this question of Brussels sovereignty over Britain is sort of an arcane question, and it animates people in Parliament. But what they've very cleverly done at last, and I'm sort of surprised it hasn't happened earlier, is got to across to people the sense that actually their number one concern is immigration. And actually, there is no point in articulating a policy of wanting to control Britain's borders if you don't also take the view that you need to leave the European Union. That is the message now that UKIP have successfully transmitted. And that's why it's so ruinous to the Conservatives, who want to, on one hand, say, yes, we have a serious policy of controlling immigration, but also still technically remain wedded to staying in the European Union. And it's very hard to do those two things at the same time.
But how can we explain this situation where UKIP seems to be so popular, and yet more people than ever want to stay in the EU, according to the Ipsos Morrie poll?
Well, because of course, UKIP's not only about its policies. UKIP is the
lifestyle fat.
Yeah. Smoking on television and drinking, that's what he does.
Well, this is interesting, sorry to interrupt very quickly, but this is what the Tory Eurosceptics say now, some of them, the ones that really want to leave the EU, is they're very worried about Farage becoming the flag bearer for the leave
none
the
of
EU
the above
because Farage himself is toxic, so you end up galvanising people who don't like the EU as a stop Farage campaign, and that ends up making people vote, you know, want to stay in the European Union.
Contradictions, but then UKIP do contradictions, don't they? It's been another eventful week for the party. This week they forged a new alliance. To qualify for EU funding, Nigel Farage has teamed up with some new mates, including a Polish far-right politician who believes that Hitler had no part in the Holocaust. Mike, they don't seem to learn, do they?
Well, Farage gets away with it because it's just a laugh, isn't it? They would have lost their EU funding. Farage hates the EU, but he's lived very well off it for 15 years, he's a city background, public school boy from the south of England who hates Europe and yet is the champion of the poor and dispossessed. Funny, isn't it? And he's got away with it, and he brought in this poll, not his party, but just him, particularly obnoxious saloon bar rough, far rougher than Nigel, in fairness to Farage, to make up the numbers and make sure he got his handle on £2 million worth of what he would otherwise call taxpayers' money. Hands on the boodle, booze and fags again. And he gets away with it. And the papers, which would otherwise be outraged if you did it or Ed Miliband did it, Hugh, they don't seem to mind.
And he gets away with it. Discuss.
I think it is because his appeal is that he's not a serious politician and therefore he can ride outside the normal rules of politics. And that might include smoking on television, but it also includes allying with, despicable and undemocratic politicians. And it means being able to rise above every challenge.
What does he actually have to do, Raf, in Europe? Does he just have to turn up?
Yes. To get your attendance allowance, you do have to periodically turn up. So, I mean, to actually pocket the money, some sort of physical presence in the building is occasionally required. But Anne's absolutely right. He's got himself into this place where, because the aura, the perception is he is the sort of the anti-politician, or he's the gadfly on this establishment whose vanity he pricks. When there are attacks on him on the terms that might be deployed against some other politician, the response is, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? It's the establishment out to get me. So this is part of, so it's a slur, it's a smear. It's very clever. I think there was also something, again, I don't want to be too sort of conspiratorial about this, but he's been given a tremendously easy ride by some of our colleagues in the press on the right. And I think part of that is because sort of flirting with a UKIP-y position and being semi-supportive sometimes of UKIP is a way of punishing the Tories and David Cameron without engaging properly with the arguments that Ed Miliband and the Labour Party make. So you get to take an oppositionist stance, you get to do it from the right, and you don't have to take seriously the argument, the economic and social arguments about equality or anything else that Labour is making. So you get the frisson of opposition, but you get to do it from the right. And that's tremendously convenient if you're a leader writer on the Telegraph or the Mail.
Choose, and there are signs that the Mail and the Telegraph are coming back on board.
Well, they did in the European elections, exactly, but only in the last week of the campaign they suddenly started unearthing pictures, helpfully sourced to them by CCHQ, of UKIP candidates giving with sort of Luftwaffe tattoos and stuff, and that will come out. But it didn't actually have a great impact, because partly because it came along too late, and partly because, again, it reinforced this sense that, well, look, the mainstream media and the establishment are out together.
So, Anne, this is great. He can go to Brussels and Strasbourg. He doesn't actually have to achieve anything there because he denounces the whole institution anyway. He can claim as much money as he wants, and if he actually messes anything up, no one cares. This is a great laugh, isn't it?
Yeah, but it can't last. This is what you have to hold on to.
Your fingers crossed there. I'll just see it if you've got your fingers crossed.
No, because there's a kind of point at which, you know, he can only get away with being unchallenged and being none of the above for as long as he is none of the above. And the moment he starts getting, you know, serious numbers of directly elected members of parliament, the moment he looks as if he might, I mean, imagine if he actually were to be influential in the formation of the next government. You know, he will come under really serious challenge then. And I am optimistic that our system's robust enough to handle him in the fullness of time.
OK, well, meanwhile, back in Britain, we had the story of the week, perhaps, the release of a semi-official UKIP song. And it was... Well, you decide.
Taxpayers' money, where does it go? Not even George Osborne knows. When we're in power and we engage, there'd be no tax on the minimum wage. Leaders committed a cardinal sin. Open the borders, let them all come in. Illegal immigrants in every town. Stand up and be counted, Blair and Brown. Oh, yes.
Oh dear, oh dear. Mike Reed there with his calypso that he talked up, defended, and then I think apologised for on Wednesday. UKIP, by the same token, said that he was only being forced to apologise and that everyone was being horrible to him, and it was perfectly okay for him to sing his song in a cod Jamaican accent. Anne, is this where we are in politics now?
Yeah, well, sorry to keep repeating myself, but this is what you get when you treat politics as soap opera. It's the characters who win. But we do, I mean, this business about kind of politics and music, I mean, that hasn't really been a good political song in my view since Jerusalem and the Red Flag.
Well, Billy Bragg's had a go, hasn't he, with a few.
Oh, come on.
Name one.
Give me a tune.
I'd find a flag for Free Nelson Mandela by Special AK, actually. That's a great song.
Yeah, but you won't sing it.
Not at this precise moment, not without a warm-up.
Mike, it seems to me that this tells us as much about UKIP as it does about the dreadfulness of the song, because I seem to remember, I'm just about old enough to recall things like That Was the Week It Was, and Lance Percival used to do a satirical calypso every week, and because he wasn't seen as being the devil incarnate in terms of social division, no one really minded that much, or maybe it's just another age.
Yes, there was a famous calypso singer called maybe Cy Grant, who was on the Tonight programme, who was a charming man and very popular, so he probably he got off the back of that. It's about, I assume when Reed says it was no racist intention, I'm assuming he's a sincere man. I don't know much about him, but it was taken badly by people, and people are entitled to be offended and say, you can't say that if you're making a UKIP tune because they're tainted. So he probably did the right
thing.
So
that's the issue, Raph. It's because it was UKIP, it's because of the baggage that UKIP already have.
I think there's also a generation thing. I think you're right. There was a time when a white man could do a cod Caribbean accent.
Do you mean Steve?
So, and and now it comes across as slightly unpleasant, and in the context of UKIP. But let's remember, Mike Reed has got form on this, because actually you're maybe old enough to remember That Was the Week That Was. I'm young enough to remember Saturday Superstore and the Search for a Superstore Superstar that gave us It's Horrible Being in Love When You're 8 1/2, and that was a much much worse song than the UKIP calypso.
So frankly, there are many Mike Reed crimes against musicality. Yes, yeah. As one would expect, because no crime goes unanswered, there is already a response calypso to this. It's from a proper respected calypso artist called Alexander D. Great, get it, who anticipated the discussion on this podcast, and he sent me his own musical riposte. And so we're going to play out with that. My thanks to Raphael Bear, Anne Perkins and Michael White. Thank you, of course, to Alexander D. Great as well, who you can check out on his website, alexanderdgreat.net. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thank you for listening, and take it away, Alex.
An ex-Radio 1 DJ has been criticized for a so-called calypso, and I am surprised. Are you telling me this man does not really know that Jamaica's first music is called Mento? They say he has a faux Jamaican accent, but what concerns me more is the content. One thing he says UKIP wants for this nation is a big clampdown on immigration. Is this a copycat crime? I hear the warning bells start to chime. This guy so art form once so sublime, now cheap and cheerful, not worth a dime. From the time that this place was ruled by Rome, soldiers from North Africa made this their home. So black people were here before the English came, from a German region, Saxony by name. Some have said this song's a sign of racism, but it might more likely just be plagiarism, because the tune that was used for this calypso had already been heard sung by King Radio. Is this a copycat crime? I hear the warning bells start to chime. This guy so art form once so sublime, now cheap and cheerful, not worth a dime. Mr. Reed, there's something you should understand. English folk music accompanied by brass band is the music of which UKIP might approve. So for goodness sake, Mike, get out of the groove. Leave satirical singing to those who know what it means to deliver a calypso. And for UKIP members feeling a bit uptight, some of my best friends are black, brown, red and white. Is this a copycat crime? I hear the warning bells start to chime. This guy so art form once so sublime. Please, Mr. Reed, do not waste our time.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code GUARDIAN.